Next case is United States v. Hale. Appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey. And may it please the court, I'm Major Alan Abrams, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Ortiz, I represent the appellant, Lieutenant Colonel James Hale. Chief Judge Stuckey, may I reserve 3 minutes?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jurisdiction over reservists is limited by definite starting and stopping points delineated by Article 2 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. In this case, the prosecution burdened itself with proving up a jurisdictional framework that meandered in and out of those starts and stops. Two requirements flowed from that choice relevant to this appeal, neither of which was satisfied. First, for the offense of attempt, each element must be met by conduct that fell within the limited times during which there was court-martial jurisdiction. Second, the military judge's instructions concerning the charged time frame and the consideration of both charged and uncharged conduct must focus the members consistent with the limited times during which there was court-martial jurisdiction. Now, underpinning the entirety of appellant's argument in this case is one common understanding, and that is that there are these starts and stops for reserve jurisdiction. And we get that from Duncan v. Usher, from this court's predecessor, where it talks about that reserve, being on reserve status is an all-or-nothing condition. That follows all the way through the statutory framework here, where there is the legislative disfavor of broad military jurisdiction, and which this court talked about in, most recently, I believe it is, in the Morita decision, and also with the specifics set out in Article 2 of the Code. That can ultimately be traced back to a constitutional concern, which the Supreme Court talked about in Solorio, and having to do with the limits and making sure that court-martial action is limited, remains within the confines of what Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14 permits. Now, relevant to the first granted issue in this case, one of the particulars that we're focused on with that has to do with inactive duty training, or IDTs. And from our perspective, the lower court correctly interpreted Article 2A3 and the regulations that apply for twining IDTs as limiting those to these four-hour blocks. Because of that, the question then turns to whether jurisdiction could be found by the purported overt act of staying at Lieutenant Colonel Hale's in-laws.
Well, the government kind of pounded away on staying. But it's not really just staying, is it? What about 2C?
No, sir. Go ahead.
Didn't he fulfill the test under 2C? I mean, I spent 21 years in this program. I filled out hundreds of 40As. I got paid. Sometimes I didn't get paid. But I know this program pretty well.
Thank you for the volunteer service.
Absolutely. But what about 2C?
Your Honor, it's our position that Article 2C doesn't apply. And I know that this court talked about in footnote 5 of Morita that Article 2C could conceptually apply in the case of when we're talking about IDTs as the basis for jurisdiction. But there's four reasons that shouldn't be the case.
Tell me the four reasons.
The first reason, Your Honor, has to do with the text of Article 2C itself. And although at the front part of the statute it talks about notwithstanding any other provision of law, and then it sets out the four-factor test, we also have to focus on what follows those four factors, where specifically it talks about is subject to this chapter until such person's active service. That contemplates that they were on active service to begin with. And active service is defined in 10 U.S.C. Section 101D3 as being either active duty or full-time National Guard service. So it would be strange to have jurisdiction arise when someone is going on orders for, say, an IDT tour, who then find themselves only unable to come off of that IDT tour when active service, whatever it is that governs the active service, would permit them to come off. Additionally, there is the concern that the lower court talked about, as well as the Army Court and their Wolpert decision that's talked about also in the court below. Where
can you speak up?
I apologize, Your Honor. There's a concern basically that it would render Article 2A3 superfluous in that it might swallow Article 2A3. There's also two concerns related to legislative intent, one being the general concept that jurisdiction over reservists is disfavored. It's viewed narrowly. It's something that this court talked about. I believe Judge Ryan's opinion for the court in Morita used the word cherry to say basically that Congress doesn't like doing this. Also, there's the specific concern because ultimately the primary case that we have in Article 2C is the Phillips decision. And in the Phillips decision, they went to great lengths to look at the specific legislative history. So to the extent that there's any ambiguity about that Article 2C is not intended for instances of reservists, we can look at what they talk about in Phillips, where in one instance the court says, merely serving with the armed forces as a reservist or a civilian is not sufficient to establish jurisdiction under Article 2C, and lists Article 283 as a comparative point. And they also quote the 1979 Senate report that led to Article 2C, talking about the new subdivision is not intended to affect reservists not performing active service or civilians, which loops back to the textual argument that I made before. Lastly, Your Honor, in terms of the Phillips, if we were to actually apply, so the fourth reason that we have is to actually apply the test itself, you think the lower court looked at it correctly, were they looking at the actual Phillips factors as well as the statutory factors, and in particular, when we look at the latter three factors.
So the CCA did it right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, but the CCA hung its hat on staying.
We don't think they did that part right, Your Honor.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's staying? I need to ask the government this, but I'm going to ask you first. Okay, he's staying overnight with his in-laws while he performs IDT on, say, consecutive days. Okay.
Well, he was doing that, Your Honor, and we're not disputing that.
No. He's staying overnight with his in-laws. There's no problem with staying overnight with one's in-laws. One can stay as long as one's in-laws can stand having you around. The problem is staying with one's in-laws and then claiming government reimbursement for staying with one's in-laws when it didn't cost you anything. And the CCA said that's enough. So, where are we? I mean, where are we with staying? Well, it's staying plus, and the plus is trying to cheat the government. And so, where are we with staying? Because that's what they ended up hanging their hat on.
They did end up hanging their hat on staying with regard to what is now issue one in this case.
Right.
And so we're not disputing the plain language of staying should apply. We're not disputing that Lieutenant Colonel Hale used the word in his statement during the command direct investigation to say that he was staying. Our issue is, one, that it is that there wasn't jurisdiction because it was outside the four-hour blocks. Now, that said, we understand that there's maybe a plain language issue with that. Alternatively, though, even if it counts as an overt act, in our view, it doesn't rise to the level of being a substantial step, which is...
Oh, okay, that's okay.
Counsel, do you have a view as to what, like, how much of an offense has to be committed while the person is during their period of IDT for court-martial jurisdiction to attach to the act, to the person for the act?
Judge Ryan, it would have to be sufficient conduct, and I know that's a somewhat amorphous answer, but it's sufficient conduct to satisfy all the elements for the offensive attempt. So there would have.
Let's say it's not attempt. Let's say just straight larceny.
Would have to be all the elements for the offensive larceny.
So someone's on they're on IDT, right? They get a hold of a gun, they shoot someone, then they go off IDT, and then the person dies. Court-martial jurisdiction, no court-martial jurisdiction. Because you need to have a dead body for murder, right?
You do, Your Honor. We're not disputing that. I think that would be a much closer question. And to be upfront, Your Honor, that's a very hard question. I think it's got some parallels to this particular case in the sense that some of the offenses that, only one offense had every single sort of conceptual point in this case fall within the time frame during which Lieutenant Colonel Hale was on orders. A lot of them had something like similar to the example that you gave where there's receipt of payment after he comes off of orders.
I guess what I'm asking is why would that be the rule as opposed to a more common sense rule, which is if some of the conduct necessary to commit the criminal offense took place during period of IDT, that's enough to give a jurisdictional hook.
Judge Ryan, if I'm understanding.
Because otherwise, you know, people could do this all the time. And they could just, you know, do one act while they were on IDT and do the other act when they weren't on IDT and say, sorry, military, you know, you don't have jurisdiction over me because I completed the acts when I was not on IDT. And, oh, by the way, there's no state or federal prosecutor that is going to be interested in pursuing, you know, an $800 claim.
Well, the exercise of prosecutorial discretion is not really, the concern of the
– Well, carry it one step further. They sign his 40A. It's noon. They sign his 40A. He signs his 40A. They sign his 40A. He walks out the door. He goes to the Burger King on base. The base is an exclusive jurisdiction base. He pulls out a gun, holds up the Burger King, absconds with $150.
And that's not something that, in our view, that the military can prosecute. Under the amended rule, that will take effect.
Well, no, I'm not talking about the amended rule. That doesn't have any application here.
So,
yeah, what I'm saying, and there's a 40A sitting on the desk that he's supposed to start at 1300. Again, another 4-hour IDT. Although we, you know. So what you're saying is nobody reaches it. It's an exclusive jurisdiction base, so downtown isn't going to do anything. And the Air Force has no jurisdiction.
It's up to downtown whether or not they want to do something.
Counsel, just to be clear, I don't dispute that under the version of the rule in effect, Dern is saying that if all of the elements of the offense had taken place not during a period of IDT, that there would be no jurisdiction. So I'm asking a very different question, which is, what if some of the elements take place while he's on IDT?
And it, at least for the...
That's kind of the only interesting question in this whole case.
Judge Ryan, so at least for the offenses of attempt, which are in the granted issue one and then the specified issue, if the event that occurs during the time frame of the IDT would count as a substantial step or as an overt act and a substantial step and meet the remaining elements for the offense of attempt,
You're saying meet the remaining elements, so you're saying all of them.
All four elements for the offense of attempt as described in Payne.
And because why?
Because it comes back to the constitutional concern, Judge Ryan, and that's because if there's something that occurred outside of, if we're relying...
But we're defining the contours of something, right, which is something everything or is it some things?
Judge Ryan, I'm not sure I understand that question, but let me see if I can clarify sort of what our position is.
Well, something would be two elements. Everything would be all four elements.
Everything would be all four elements. All four elements would have to be met within the time frame during which there's court-martial jurisdiction. If an element is met by...
No. During which there's court-martial jurisdiction, that assumes it.
I'm just asking why isn't it equally plausible to read the rule to say as long as some of the elements took place during the period of IDT, that's enough to satisfy personal jurisdiction over this accused for this offense, even if the remaining elements occurred when he went off IDT.
As long as one of those elements is a substantial step.
Wait, and Judge Ryan, my answer would basically be sort of the latter part of Judge Olson's question, which is...
No, because you said substantial step and the other elements.
Judge Ryan. So you seem to be saying to Judge Ryan that all the elements, there has to be not only a substantial step during the time that they're within the military's jurisdiction, but all the elements of the offense must have been committed by the accused during the time that they are on active duty training. Is that your argument?
Our argument is that, let's say that there is one act that would not constitute a completed offense that occurs during an IDT block. If that element, or if that act, assuming it is an overt act, constitutes a substantial step, evinces the requisite specific intent, and tends to affect the completed offense, thereby meeting all four elements for the offensive attempt, then the government may prosecute, then the military may prosecute that.
Counsel, well, can I just... Then why isn't what he did a substantial step? Why isn't staying under these circumstances, not the bald act of staying, but staying basically with the intent to screw the government, not a substantial step.
And Chief Justice Stuckey, it depends on how you look at the conduct that's outside of that time frame, because a lot of the government's argument in that sense is looking at a lot of things that Lieutenant Colonel Hale did outside of the time frame during which he was subject to orders. So that conduct, had it been properly treated in this case, would have been instructed under as 404 evidence. And while it might show intent, the substantial step question is what this court articulated in Winkleman, where it has to unequivocally demonstrate that a crime is going to occur absent interruption by independent circumstances.
If you look at, and I think that that was unfortunate language, and I take fault for that, because if you look at the examples after that, it's clear that it's just the ordinary rule for substantial step.
And if the Winkleman test is not as it appears to us by the language of the test, then it may indeed count as a substantial step. But then a bigger, broader question arises in this case when we look at the instructional issue. And I know that I'm short on time, but if I may. On the instructional issue in particular, we have a concern when we look at not only the first part of the military judge's instruction where he's talking about on or about, but actually the specific things that he's telling the members to look at as being those potential substantial steps. He's telling them to look at staying. That's one issue. But he's also telling them to look at the receipt and the check. The receipt that Lieutenant Colonel Hale created and the check. And that's a problem for at least three of the specifications in this case that are attempt offenses, because all three of those being the specification of charge 2 as well as specifications 2 and 3 of additional charge 2, have those things falling outside the jurisdictional time frame. So if you agree with us with the appellant.
Counselor, can I ask you to stop you for just a minute? I know you don't have much time, but why would not the defense counsel didn't object to that, right?
That's correct, Justice.
And a proper objection would have been that these are uncharged acts and they should not be considered. Is that right?
Not with regard to the instruction, Justice.
No, I'm saying when this evidence was coming in, when the evidence was coming in about these other circumstances, could not the and should not the defense counsel have objected and said these circumstances are uncharged acts? They are not relevant, and if they are relevant, they're only relevant under 404B. Is that right?
I see I'm out of time.
Please answer the question.
Ms. Sparks, you're right. That is what they should have done. In terms of Issue 2, though, what we're evaluating is the instructional aspect.
Right, but the defense counsel not having done that, you're saying, or it sounds like you're saying the judge should have sui sponte given an instruction to that effect. Are you saying that or not?
Well, the military judge had an obligation under RCM 920 to make sure that his instructions comply with the law, and to the extent that his instructions open the door for the members to rest a general verdict on conduct that was outside the court-martial's jurisdiction.
In the absence of an objection from the accused counsel?
Then it's a plain error test, Judge Sparks. But otherwise, then we run into sort of the Stromberg problem that this court described in Pylunik and that the Supreme Court talked about in Griffin. And I see I'm out of time. If there are other further questions, I'm more than glad to take them up. Otherwise, I know I'll
thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court. May it please the court, I'm Captain Peter Kellett, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States.
Could you speak up, please?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize.
Thank you.
I'm going to first discuss Issues 1 and 3 since they are very interrelated, and then move on to Issue 2 to discuss the on or about instructions. Under Issues 1 and 3, the lower court did not err because substantial steps occurred during the charge time frame. Therefore, the court-martial had jurisdiction. I'm going to start with Issue 1 because Issue 1 specifically talks about staying. And staying should be given its plain meaning, first of all.
Counsel, when you address that topic, can you talk about the standard of review? Is this a question of fact that we would only disagree with it if it was clearly erroneous, or is this a question of law as to when someone's staying during the working hours?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it would be a legal sufficiency question whether or not this would the staying occurred during the charge time frame and whether or not that equated to a substantial step.
I understand that. The theory of the case is, for the government's perspective, is that although he was physically located in the office during the working hours, the IDT hours. He was still doing something else. He was staying consecutively. And I believe the appellant disagrees with that. And my question is that a question of fact or is that a question of law?
So, Your Honor, I misunderstood
the question. The question is, you know, is he doing both at once? Is that a question of law or fact?
That would be a question of fact, Your Honor. And that goes directly to our argument with whether or not the appellant stayed during these periods of IDT. And to that, the government's position is that staying should be given its plain meaning. Meaning, when someone stays somewhere, they reside somewhere temporarily. And it starts when that person checks in, if it's a hotel, for example, when they check in, and it ends when that person checks out. So during these periods of IDTs, when they were week-long periods or two-week-long periods, whatever the case may be, depending on the specification, he was staying from when he first arrived at his in-law's house and when he left his in-law's house to go back to his home.
Why isn't what constitutes a stay a question of law and whether he met that definition a question of fact? I mean, I'm not saying that is how it plays out, but I'm just asking you to consider why couldn't that be the answer? And does it matter?
Well, I don't think it matters in terms of on either question. I think that the government's position is that we would win on either question. So if it was a legal, if you're looking at whether or not this is legally sufficient to support staying, it would because it did amount to a substantial step. And I think that answers your question, Judge Ryan.
No, my question is why couldn't the question of what constitutes staying be a question of law, and then whether he met that be a question of fact?
Oh, that could be the case, yes, Your Honor.
Does it matter?
I don't think it does matter, Your Honor, for this court's determination of this issue. I don't think it does matter, Your Honor. And moving on.
I think it's undeniable that he stayed. He brought his bags, dumped them in the spare bedroom, put on his uniform, and trotted off to the base and did whatever it is he's supposed to do during IDT. But I spoke to counsel in terms of staying plus. But is it staying plus? I mean, he presumably formed at some time this intent to do what he did. But if he didn't form it during an IDT period, and staying without more isn't an offense, then where are we?
So, Your Honor, I think it's important to realize the unique circumstances of this case, where the reason he was not charged or convicted of the actual completed larceny is because of the jurisdictional confines. That we have to prosecute someone under the confines of jurisdiction, whether or not they're on status or not. So in this,
that goes to my question, which is, do you agree that all elements of the offense have to be completed while first someone's on a period of IDT for them to be charged with the completed offense?
No, Your Honor, and I think this court's decision in Coomerly answers that question, where all acts that are elements of the offense do not have to be completed during periods of jurisdiction or subject when the person is subject to the UCMJA. For example, in Coomerly, the person or the appellant in that case posted the image online before entering active duty, and the delivery of that image didn't occur until after that person was on active duty. And this court still found the completed offense, the completed crime of distribution in that case. So I think that case would be instructive to answer your question, Your Honor. And
did the government complain to the military judge or to the CCA about that point? Basically that he was only convicted of attempt because of a misunderstanding of the law?
No, Your Honor, and that's not one of the granted issues on appeal right now. But it is instructive in terms of these substantial steps and looking outside these periods of IDT to determine whether or not he formed the specific intent. So back to your question, Judge Stuckey, whether or not this is staying plus or staying is unique in this case because we have completed offenses. So we know that he had that specific intent at some point because he actually did either complete the offense or file the final travel vouchers.
Right, he filed the voucher, he made up the receipt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, at some point.
So under the facts of this case, it would be important to consider that to determine whether or not he had the specific intent to complete the crime of larceny at the time he was staying with his in-law.
So in light of that, let's say that we have a bank robber. He goes to a bank with a drive-through teller, and twice on two separate dates, he robs the teller. He has both a note and he has a firearm. FBI arrests him on a different date when he drives up through the drive-through window, but he does not have a note. He does not have a firearm. He also doesn't have any cash. He wants cash through using an ATM card, using it through the drive-through teller. Are you saying that they would have an attempted bank robbery there?
So no, in that situation.
So what is the distinction between that scenario and this one where all we have is an overt act that could in fact be benign? This time he could have decided to be honest.
Well, I think it's important to realize too, under issue one, we're looking at the specification that deals with 19 November 2013. And during this period of IDTs, we don't just have the staying, Your Honor. We also have the fact that he created the fake receipt again. He wrote the check.
And I'm focusing on specification three of additional charge two.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're focusing on that as well? Because in terms of spec three of additional charge two, all we really have is his staying with the in-laws. We don't have, as we do with the other specification, the other steps that he took in terms of writing a check, creating the fraudulent lodging receipt, and so forth. We don't have that with spec three of additional charge two, do we?
So in regards to specification three of additional charge two, we do, Your Honor. We have the fact that he created a receipt. This is on in the joint appendix at page 365, and that he wrote a check. That's on page 366 of the joint appendix. And then he later submitted a travel voucher for this stay as well. And outside of this.
So that's not specification two of additional charge one? I realize that it's difficult when we're throwing around the numbers like that, but I just want to be clear. Are you referring to specification two of additional charge one or specification three of additional charge two?
Specification three of additional charge
two. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe the first one you said was specification two of additional charge one. Is that the first one you're
yes.
talking about? Yes, Your Honor. Those acts are on different parts of the JA, in earlier parts of the JA. And I apologize, I do not have those at the ready to give you direct cites to that. But for specification three of additional charge two.
So we can get past the different numbers here that might be confusing. Are you saying, let me draw it into a broader picture, broader context. Are you saying that with all specifications of whatever charge, that during the time he was on active duty, he had committed substantial steps in each instance, and that in each instance it included the creation of lodging receipts and filing of checks and so forth?
So at the very least, Your Honor, he stayed, and if he did not commit these other acts.
But that goes to the point. You're saying that merely staying for one of these specifications, merely staying in the context of knowing that he had engaged in criminal conduct in the past involving staying, that merely staying constituted a substantial step and therefore was sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would point this court's attention to the decision in United States v. Smith in 1999, cited in the briefs. And this court relied on evidence that the appellant in that case had previously devised and executed a scheme she was charged with committing in that case. In that case, it dealt with a credit card fraud scheme. And the court relied on evidence that she had previously done this before. And in reaching the decision of affirming an attempted credit card scheme in that case. And the court pointed out that it needed to focus on evidence in its entirety to come to its decision on whether or not something was a substantial
scheme. So let's get back to my analogy, and maybe it's not apt, but you've got the person who drives up the third time to drive through teller. We don't have any evidence of a note to the teller. We don't have any evidence of a firearm. You're saying that the mere driving up to the drive-through teller means that the individual could be not only charged with but convicted of the attempted bank robbery.
So I think, Your Honor, I think your analogy would be like saying if the appellant stated his in-laws, and then when he checked out of his in-laws and left his in-laws, he was arrested and charged with attempt for that instance. But we have more than him just sitting at the teller in this case. We also have the fact that he created the receipt for the stay. He wrote the check that he knew was never going to be cash, and he filed the final travel voucher.
So is your, just so I can tease this out, so what you're saying then is just staying at the in-laws without more is not legally sufficient to constitute an attempt, correct?
Correct.
But in this case, we're looking at jurisdiction, and was that a substantial step combined with the other things to constitute an attempt?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you're just saying that it was a substantial step for purposes of jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
Another clarifying question on that, which is, in other words, in determining whether this was an attempt that occurred during IDT, we are not limited to looking at evidence of things that happened during IDT. We can look at things that happened after IDT to determine whether what did happen during IDT was a substantial step. Is that the government's position?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that's supported by the decision in Smith and Coomerly, as I previously mentioned.
Captain Keller, along that same line, what's your response to appellate defense counsel's complaint that, hey, look, the military judge should have on his own advise the members about how to view these other circumstances, although they were not objected to? In other words, they're uncharged acts. And even though appellate defense counsel concedes that there was no objection, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong when you get on rebuttal, but I think he's saying that notwithstanding that, the judge should have informed the members about these circumstances. I'm not sure what he would have said, but, you know, and not having done that is part of the failure on the part of the military judge. What's your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I think this kind of will be a segue into issue two, the honor about language. But the judge didn't have a duty to do that because the judge relied on the precedent of Phillips and Morita interpreting Article 2C, which basically says, notwithstanding other provisions of law, if someone is serving with the armed force and they satisfy the four parts of the statute and also the factors in Phillips, that there could be jurisdiction even if they're not doing something within these blocks of IDT. And I think that's evidenced by the military judge's ruling on jurisdiction, which is on page 480 of the JA, which in paragraph 18, the judge cites to Article 2C to say that there is jurisdiction for things that don't happen within these finite periods of time on these IDTs because 2C allows jurisdiction to reach individuals that are serving with the armed force and meet the requirements of Article 2C. And that's why, for that precise reason, the state of the law did not make it plain error for the judge to instruct on honor about. Because given the precedent of Phillips and Morita, the state of the law did not say that Article 2C could not apply to period of IDTs. And because there was no plain error, there was also no prejudice because the dates are certain in this case. All the dates where the individual was subject to the UCMJ are in black and white on either the Form 40As or under the range of dates on on pieces of paper that told the members when he was subject to the UCMJ on active duty. And the members found appellant guilty as charged in this case. There were no exceptions or substitutions that expanded the scope of the charges to cover periods that he was not subject to the UCMJ. An appellant cannot demonstrate he was convicted for acts that occurred when he was not subject to the UCMJ. For example, in the specification of charge 2, and supported by pages 336 through 337 of the joint appendix, that showed he sent, filled out travel vouchers to approving officials for the request. And I apologize that getting into the weeds of the specifications may cause more confusion than is probably as helpful, but I would ask the court to, or I submit to the court that the appellant was only convicted of acts that he did while he was on active duty, whether it be a substantial step or whether it be acts to satisfy the completed crime of larceny. Therefore, the appellant's failure to demonstrate that all three prongs of the plain error test shows that the lower court did not err in finding that the on or about language to be proper.
So from a sufficiency standpoint, you're saying that no reasonable juror or member in this case would have found him guilty of anything outside the times he was subject to jurisdiction. Is that what, notwithstanding the fact that the charged period covers days that he was not subject to jurisdiction?
As affirmed by the lower court, no, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I understand that the lower court did modify one of the two of the specifications to be attempts instead of completed larcenies, mm-hmm. and they detailed the reasons why that was the case, because the lower court did not agree that Phillips applied. And while that's the lower court's determination, that wasn't apparent at the time of trial that Phillips would not apply. And as affirmed, there are no issue with acts that occurred outside of periods of active duty or inactive duty. So in conclusion, the court martial had jurisdiction over the substantial steps committed during the specifications at issue in issues one and three. And there's no plain error and no prejudice under issue two with the on or about language. The law at the time and today does not clearly state that Phillips or Morita would not apply to the circumstances of the appellant's acts. There was no prejudice due to the evidence supporting precise dates that fit squarely within the charge frames of which the members found him guilty of as charged. Therefore, this court should respectfully affirm the decision of the lower court. And pending any further questions from the court.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could start with Judge Sparks' question.
It's going to be a while for everybody.
I know,
Chief.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry and you're welcome. to start with Judge Sparks' question concerning the instructions, let me just clarify our position in terms of the back and forth that we had. What I understood us to be talking about, and perhaps what you were talking about with trial counsel, Judge Sparks, had to do with the proper instruction of evidence, as, say, 404 evidence. And that's certainly relevant to issues 1 and 3 in terms of this other stuff should have been instructed as 404, but that's ultimately not something that we would prevail on because you're right, it wasn't challenged below. Our position, though, has to do with the instruction itself concerning on or about and the charge time frame, because when we look at the on or about, and then when we see that the military judge says to the members, and you can convict him for a receipt that was outside of the court's jurisdiction, or a check that he signed outside of the court's jurisdiction. We have the specific citations for those in our appendix. I can certainly walk the court through those if you'd like. But for the specification of charge 2, as well as specifications 2 and 3 of charge, additional charge 2, that possibility was left open based on those dates that are in black and white that my colleague referred to. That's problematic because of what the Supreme Court talked about in Griffin, which is that when a provision of the Constitution forbids conviction on a particular ground, the constitutional guarantee is violated by a general verdict that may have rested on that ground. It doesn't have to have rested on that ground, so long as it may have rested on that ground. And that's problematic for the government with regard to those specifications, because if the members may have relied on those things that were outside of the court's jurisdiction, and for all three of those that the specifications that I just cited.
Was this raised below?
Your Honor, we raised the issue concerning on or about below.
Well, you raised the on or about issue, but the general verdict issue.
We certainly cited
Griffin.
We certainly cited to the cases below, and we did say that it mattered for these specifications. And I don't think either brief did a really good job of articulating just the gravity of this particular issue.
Go ahead.
So that's our concern here with regard to those specifications. So let me give the court kind of the cleanest way. As much as we've spent talking about substantial step, I think there's perhaps a cleaner way to resolve some of the issues in this case. The first step of that being, if I could take up the specified issue, for the specified issue, this court's precedent says that if something is a lesser included offense, then the conviction may stand. And if this court, rather than necessarily grappling with the staying issue, perhaps it's decided just as the substantial step. But that's also because we view and have not challenged that the receipt and the check are a substantial step. Again, though, in our view, that's problematic on issue two. Chief Justice, if I could just briefly close on that.
Please do.
For the other specifications related to issue two, we think resolution is appropriate on the reasons that we stated in our brief for why we should prevail on the other specifications under issue two, and that would largely spare the court from having to grapple with the substantial step issue that we spent so much time talking about. Pending further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court will be in recess until 09:30 tomorrow.
All rise. Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.